Hello, grandkids, and welcome to the Valentine's Day edition of Stunt Granny Audio Presents OPA number 126. This is Kevin DeFrango. Sitting beside me in his lovely, fine basement is Ken Phillips. What is going on, good sir?
Well, I'm doing real good, and I'm very happy to hear that you think that my basement is both lovely and fine. that's probably how I would describe it too, Kevin.
Yeah, well, you don't want to see our basement still. It's probably in worse shape.
Yeah, just... things are a little bit cluttered here at the moment. We had been on an upswing in the basement, but there's been a couple projects that are sort of ongoing and in pieces around us at the moment.
Doesn't it always seem to happen that way? Like, you start to go in the one direction, like, oh man, it's looking really nice in here, wherever that is. Yeah. And then you're like, all of a sudden it's like, ah shit, how did it get this dirty? Yeah. Or how did it get this messy? Maybe not dirty is probably not the right word.
Yeah.
Why is there stuff everywhere?
Yeah. And
we just organized this a month ago.
Such is the human condition, Kevin, I guess. What is it? Disorder must increase. Isn't that sort of the one of those fundamental theories of physics or something?
I do believe that is there at some point.
It's tough to fight against that.
Yeah, chaos reigns. Yep. is pretty much.
We're just riding that wave.
Yeah, you just got to learn to control it as best you can. Roll with the punches, baby.
That's right.
And I'll tell you what, Ken, we definitely were rolling with a lot of punches this year as Pittsburgh Steelers fans. Mm.
Yeah.
And those punches have continued to come even after the dastardly New England Patriots captured their sixth Super Bowl, thus tying the Steelers for most Super Bowl wins.
Yeah. You know, I remember, and I don't know, I'm just putting this together now, and I hopefully didn't jinx the team this year, but I can remember thinking myself at the beginning of the season when there was these negative articles coming out about the New England Patriots and like how Tom Brady's personal doctor is like banned from their practice facilities. There's some potential bad blood between him and Belichick. A couple articles to that effect.
Oh.
I might have, you know, had a bit of schadenfreude at the beginning of the season where I was sort of looking forward to seeing these people kind of brought low, I guess. And I feel like that in somehow boomeranged around onto the Steelers because now they are the subject of all the turmoil, it seems like, in the league, or at least most of it.
Yeah, and they've seemingly at least cleared off the Le'Veon Bell situation for the most part. I hope that they just don't, because they still can sign him to another contract. So I think there's another type of franchise tag that they can label him. But I really hope they don't. I hope they're not stupid enough to go that route and just move forward and draft a running back backup for James Conner this coming draft, which I think would be easy enough. And yeah. Just move forward that way. The Antonio Brown situation took another twist this week, in which he formally requested a trade. As I showed you, I saw some, because I knew that it's going to be really tough. I do believe that our good buddy, oh, and you probably didn't see this news, Joe Flacco.
Oh.
Is being traded to the Broncos.
Interesting.
But I believe that because it's the league year, they can't be traded until after 3/17, which makes this thing kind of weird. This tweet that we're looking at from Field Yates is that Antonio Brown is due a roster bonus of $2.5 million on March 17th.
So that's basically the difference in between what the cap hit would be, it looks like, because it's roughly $2.5 million there.
Yeah.
So it's a difference of $23.6 million or $21.1 million. And, you know, it's pretty much a lot of money either way, I would say.
Yeah, and it's still weird to me that the cap hit is higher than their actual salary. I'm not quite sure that I understand NFL math, to be completely honest with you.
At least some of it is the amount that they pay in a signing bonus that doesn't count towards that first year. It gets spread out over
the course of time.
Yeah, and so I think then they have to kind of take that whole hit at once if they trade the player.
Yeah, and I definitely knew this part. I didn't know the numbers, but if the Steelers trade him before the 17th, they have a dead cap space of, for the next 2 years, of $21 million and $23.6 million.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of dead cap space.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And especially when you combine that with they were already looking to be taking a hit with the Le'Veon Bell situation. It's not great.
Yeah, and there's definitely a performance on the field issue that, you know, would definitely happen if Brown is not there. Which, I mean, we haven't even touched on yet.
Right.
But the other part is that he is turning 31 in July. So before the next NFL season starts, he's on the wrong side of 30 for any sports athlete. Yeah. Despite the fact that the man keeps himself and I do believe I have noted jealousy of his abs. Of course, drinking beer does me zero favors in that situation. And beer greater than abs, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think you've got some good priorities there, Kevin. Yeah.
But on top of that, so he's 31. Whoever does trade for him, his salary the next 3 years is 12.6, 11.3, and 12.5. So if he's turning 31 this season, that means he'd be 33 the final season that they're paying him a large chunk of change.
So theoretically, the Steelers could just totally cut him if they couldn't trade him based on these his contract numbers here. Am I right in saying this? I'm not an expert on NFL trades and, you know, the NFLPA rules and whatnot.
Yeah. The chances that they cut him, to me, are somewhere between slim and none. And I'm definitely leaning towards none.
At the same time, though, if there's a guy who has said he wants to be traded, do you think it's really great to have him playing for your team? I don't know.
Those numbers to me say that he is not getting traded. That is just my personal opinion on the situation. And I do believe a number of the Pittsburgh reporters that I follow are still saying that he is quite likely to be playing for the Pittsburgh Steelers this coming season. So I'm not the only person who is of this mindset. People who follow the NFL feel like those things are definitely enough of a deterrent that despite his unhappiness, that there's a solid chance that he's in black and gold this coming season.
I just wonder what what they have to, I mean, we saw what happened with Le'Veon Bell when he wasn't happy. He didn't end up playing. They ended up paying him. Well, no, they didn't end up paying him, but still they, took the cap hit.
yeah.
So we could be in for a similar situation with Antonio Brown next year, which is unfortunate. Obviously.
Yeah, and I about fell over laughing when I saw people thought that they'd get a first rounder for Antonio Brown. Like, when Randy Moss was still great, I think the Patriots traded a second rounder for him. Like, trades in the NFL are so bizarre.
And Randy Moss was probably towards, you know...
He was probably in a similar situation when he got traded. You know, like, he's probably the same age range.
That's what I was thinking.
As Antonio Brown is currently. So, yeah, like, they're not getting a first rounder for him. Like, as great as he has been and as great as... Really, he still even was this season...
Well, he was getting a lot of double teams, it felt like, this season. So it's hard to, like, say. I mean, that obviously opens up other receivers.
Yeah, Juju Smith-Schuster definitely made people pay for the double teams on Antonio Brown this past season.
Yeah, and I think that would probably be frustrating because, you know...
You're definitely used to getting the ball.
And if he has... possibly incentive-based things in his contract. I don't know. A lot of players do, I know. But, and it can just be good for his career, too, I would say, to be able to put up some good stats. So, I don't know. It's a hard thing to necessarily knock him too much for being upset. But he should be a professional about it at the same time. So, I'm not defending his behavior at all.
And the funny thing is, this was one thing that I did listen to. I do like this little segment that I'm trying to think of what his Chris Carter does on a website that I no longer pay money to, but I get their free podcast. It's called "Don't Get Me Started," and he was just mentioning how, for as much of the off the field antics that happened to the Steelers. That it was the on-the-field performance that really cost them. It was not the off-the-field drama that cost them to have a tie game against the Browns.
Oh, right.
It was not Antonio Brown throwing a couch out of his... allegedly throwing a couch out of his Miami apartment that cost them a game in New Orleans... You know, it was a questionable pass interference call that the Saints fans were not worried about at that time. It's funny how they're okay when it favors them, but when it's against them, they seem to have a problem.
Yeah, and I would also say that you probably had a lot of Steelers fans less interested in the niceties of NFL rules, say during the Seattle Seahawks Super Bowl. So it all depends on you know, how the call affects your team, I would say, unfortunately.
Yeah, I definitely saw it was kind of funny. I did see an article about that Super Bowl because that was 10 years ago that happened, I guess I was a little surprised that it had been that long, but I guess also not surprised because it has been a while. It was funny that a Seattle fan was the one that brought the article to my attention.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they've lived that one down quietly.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It was funny that one thing did come of it. I guess that Mike Pereira that now does TV analysis is one of the ref checkers. He had a vacation planned for the day after the Super Bowl, and that was, he left and was, no one was able to get a hold of him because he was out of country.
Oh.
And so they actually made a rule that, no one's allowed to take a vacation in the NFL head office. For a week after the Super Bowl, in case something controversial like that happens.
Oh, wow.
That was one thing that came of that game.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, when the head of officiating bails on answering those types of questions, I can understand why a change would happen.
Yeah, like, peace out. Probably not the best time for a, although you would think maybe it would be a good time because the season's over, you know, most years.
Yeah, you do not have that level of scrutiny of the officiating. There is 100% chance that you're going to argue with a call during any game on any Sunday. But sometimes the level of arguing might be a little bit higher than at other times. And that was certainly one of them. There were a few questionable calls in that one.
Yeah. Speaking of calls or non-calls, I guess, did you happen to catch any of the, was it American Football League?
Oh, no, I did not.
Over the weekend?
No, I saw that it was on and then realized that the Penguins were playing and figured it was much better to watch hockey.
Yeah, I didn't. I actually had completely forgotten that was a thing.
Yeah, I'm just quietly waiting for the XFL to come around next year, Ken.
Oh, right. And that did remind me of that, then, that weird video that we watched with Vince McMahon, where he was, I don't know, he had a very strange vibe about him, I would say, for that video. a very Bond villain-esque, I would say, almost.
Well, that's kind of his character, really. Right. So,
yeah,
I guess this is not surprising to me.
Yeah, it was in character for sure. But I did see that there was a brutal sack on a unaware quarterback that was not called for a penalty, and resulted in the quarterback's helmet flying like seemingly 5 yards across the field.
Oh, geez!
So they're kind of taking a different approach to. Some of the
penalties?
Safety rules there, yeah.
Oh, well, that just seems like a terrible idea, in my opinion. There is no need for those types of hits, unless the quarterback was dumb enough not to have his helmet secured properly.
There was a difference that I liked, where they, instead of having onside kicks, they have a single 4th-and-12 play from like a 30-something yard line or something like that, instead of trying to do a onside kick.
Oh.
Which is kind of an inventive way of trying something, you know?
Yeah, because it definitely makes it difficult to convert.
Right. A 4th-and-12 is a pretty unlikely play, usually.
Yeah.
I would think.
I would think so, yeah.
But still seems somewhat makeable. You know, and exciting for the fans. Although I feel like it is part of the slow whittling away of special teams from the game of football.
That's
probably inevitable in some ways.
Yeah, considering the level of concussion that seems to be involved in special teams play, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing.
Yeah, weirdly, I think that is kind of the last remnants of, like, the original spirit of football, if you will, like, just having a bunch of people basically running at each other trying to move a ball down the field without passing, of course. That was the original way to do things.
Oh.
So I feel like it's more and more moving away from those brutal roots, so that's probably, you know... Good, although we'll see. Maybe the AFL could be a reversion to the barbarity of the past, Kevin.
Oh, yeah. Someone will love it because people are getting injured, except for the people doing it who are going to be vegetables when they're 50.
Yeah. I would think that's not cool.
I don't know why people never... The people that want to see that hit, it's just like, well, why don't you get in there, dumbass?
Yeah.
You know, I've had my brain rattled a couple of times. It's not fun.
No.
I've literally had someone break a hockey stick over my head. It is not fun.
Right. No, I feel like I've at least had a concussion a couple of times playing football. One time at practice, I can remember running into this guy, like, kind of cracking down on this play that he was pulling. And, like, I know both of us were woozy afterwards, just from how, you know, he was acting too, so.
Suck it up, Buttercup.
Yeah.
Next rep.
Yeah, basically.
Great time to have your brain rattled in high school.
Sure. At least your brain is still, growing or something like that.
Your skull's a little bit softer still, so it can bounce around a little bit easier.
Yeah, hopefully you could recover a little bit more. Once you get old and kind of get all corroded, then we're all done for. You're young, your brain is still forming connections, hopefully. Anyway, that's probably not scientifically accurate.
No, but speaking of science and bouncing,
yeah,
this
is actually a really good segue, and I hope people appreciate it.
I linked to an article about a giant magnet on a trampoline.
Yeah,
which led to you adding a couple of additional magnet videos to our Evernote list.
Yes. I also separately came across some magnet-related content that I felt like we could kind of group together in a general magnets. Aren't they really cool kind of topic?
Yeah, they're pretty crazy. Like, it's definitely something that I don't always, I don't think about frequently, but I do always remember, because one of the videos that you had was the guy trying to put together a 6-inch, well, he said it was 6x2, magnet, and I believe the circumference was 6.
Or the diameter, maybe, was 6
inches. Or the diameter, yeah.
And 2 inches thick.
And 2 inches thick.
And these were the kind of the oh my God, I'm not going to be able to say this one.
God bless, because I'm not going to try to say it.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure that this was the same, the bouncy one was the same type of magnet.
They're like the rare earth magnets, the kinds of, that are the more powerful type of magnet. And yes, these can be dangerous. I think each one of these had like a pull rating of like 1,000 kilograms, which I'm not exactly sure what that works out to be, but that's a pretty strong magnet.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. It was neodymium.
Okay. Dymium. Okay. There we go. Yes. Neodymium.
Affectionately known as the death magnet.
Yeah.
A holding power around 220 pounds.
So I would think that having one of these magnets in your house, like, you would have to be like conscious of like where you're putting this magnet. Like, it's going to attach onto something and it's going to be hard to take off again.
Yeah.
You gotta be very deliberate about how you're moving it around your house.
And that was the second video that we watched here in your basement of the gentleman trying to put together two of these 6x2 magnets. Just the fact that he needed to create a ramp, a very large wooden ramp, and put the one magnet on the bottom.
It looked like a model of like something you would imagine, you know, illustrating how they built the pyramids or something. You know, it's like this construction scaffolding ramp thing.
Yeah, that's a good description.
Just trying to paint a picture for people.
And it was, yeah, because it was long, too. Like, he didn't say how long it was, but I mean, it had a landing up top, and then it had a long slope. I would say that it is at least 5 foot.
Yeah, it was several feet long.
And he actually, where the magnets were to join, which was at the bottom of the ramp, the force was so strong that he couldn't use wood anymore and was using a hard plastic wedge at the bottom, which, again, kind of shows you the strength of this, that it was going to crush wood.
Yeah. It's these magnets were no joke around. And yeah, I would be nervous just to have them in my house, I feel like, because,
yeah, you really kind of need to have, like a room for this magnet.
If you walk in there with like a piece of metal in your hand, is it going to come like flying across the room at you? You know, I don't know. pretty messed up.
Yeah, I don't know. We might need to do a deeper dive into this guy's magnet videos to see if... because I feel like... when someone has one of those cranes that usually picks up, like, cars or something, they have the magnet, and you see in a cartoon where someone has, like, a pocket knife or something in their... And they're literally in their pocket, and they get sucked up to the magnet,
right?
Because they have metal in it. Like, it would be pretty interesting to see what level of metal you'd need
to be able to, like, actually get picked up by a magnet.
Yeah, like if back in the day when I had the piercings, if I would have been stuck to a magnet of this this strength. Or if it just would have ripped out all of my piercings where they were, which would have been quite uncomfortable.
Yeah,
I've heard, say the least.
I've heard of people having their piercings ripped out in like an MRI machine or something like that because there's like a strong magnet in there. So I would think that would be unfortunate.
Oof.
So, yeah. Another reason to be careful around magnets, I guess.
Yeah. I'll just always go back to the nipple rings and just having those get pulled out by a magnet. I'm just wincing in pain.
It's not something you're going to sign up for.
No. I'm glad I don't have them now. That would be a hard pass going in an MRI with my nipple rings in.
You never feel like you're... one of those people who would be into that kind of thing, having your nipple rings ripped out by a super powerful magnet.
Well, it just kind of reminds me of the people that hang themselves by the giant meat hooks.
Right.
Like, you gotta kind of, like, I would think that someone like that would be into wearing nipple rings into an MRI machine.
I would think so.
Because it would definitely provide a similar sensation, I would think.
I wonder if they would sort of, you know, start out at a lower setting just to kind of, like, stretch things out more, maybe. I know I could see that happening.
I'm not sure a hospital's going to let you use an MRI machine to figure this out.
Now, let me get this straight. You're trying to stretch your nipples out using our machine? It costs millions of dollars and is necessary for life-saving purposes.
Ah, man.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Well, yeah. I do wonder, because the gentleman in the videos that you provided was given the second of the magnets that he stuck together. I do wonder how much one of these death magnets cost.
I don't know. I feel like they can't be super cheap. 'Cause you've got it sounded like you have to take some precautions with them.
Well, and how do they ship? Like, does UPS just have to come with one box? Or do they not keep anything else metal in that shipment? How does he get it out of the bottom of the truck? Do they have to have a special plastic truck deliver it?
I guess the trucks would be metal. That is a very good question. Do they have to bring out the old Pony Express or something?
Well, just that to, would be quite wild if the Pony Express,
the shipping costs would be enormous,
galloping up to my door with the giant magnet. Because they don't seem, the way that he was handling them, they do not seem physically heavy.
Right. It wasn't like he was struggling. You know, they weren't. They were metal discs, about what you would expect, I would think.
Yeah, it did not seem like it was heavier than probably any other weight of its size at a gym.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know, what, 20 pounds maybe or something like that? I'm not completely sure, but it seemed pretty reasonable to move around. But, because he did another experiment with ferro fluid?
Yeah, that was the other video we were watching, which is like a kind of a oil with these tiny little iron filings put in there, or magnetite too, so that they are kind of always stirred up with the fluid. So the fluid is magnetic, basically.
Yeah, and Because I was wondering if that's what they were using for spaceships, because he was talking about solid fuels. And I don't know if they just used the magnetic filings in there, or they actually used solid fuel. Yeah,
I think they ended up using solid fuels. So, like, NASA developed this ferrofuel fluid to try to solve the problem of liquid fuels floating all around and not necessarily going where they're supposed to when you're trying to use them to power your rockets in space and zero gravity. So yeah, they ended up using solid fuel to kind of have a little more well-behaved fuel. The byproduct of these ferrofluid are still used for, I don't know what they're used for actually, aside from making YouTube videos.
which are quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Because the magnet, if you put the magnet under the ferrofluid, it really turns into what I would call spiked hair. You know, it kind of looks like a Sonic the Hedgehog kind of look.
Yeah, for sure. It's got, it's a very hedgehoggy sort of look, I would say. That's well put.
It's black, which is different than Sonic, but...
Yeah.
Because... I don't know. I didn't play Sonic that much. I was trying to think of his evil twin and what his name is, but
Shadow Hog or something like that. I don't know. I'm not really an authority on this one either, I'm afraid. But it does look pretty cool. You can see like the magnetic fields basically are being traced in three dimensions by the ferrofluid.
And that's the original video that that I had with the magnet bouncing on the trampoline, because it's the same type of magnet. It's just that it was allowed to jump or bounce on a pile of metal filings, and you can see the magnetic forces around it.
Yes,
which is pretty cool, but. I do hearken back to the later videos of with the ferrofluid, where the guy is like, I don't want to clean this up. And right. That was one of my first thoughts when I was looking at this. I'm like, how do you get all these metal filings off of this super strong magnet?
Yeah, that's got to be a huge pain in the butt. Maybe not as bad as like the ferrofluid with like the oily factor thrown into it.
Oh, right.
But still, you've got to deal with all those little magnetic pieces. Like, how would you ever get all of them off of there?
That's
the video I want to see.
Yeah, that is not addressed in any of the videos that we watched.
Yeah, I believe that the German gentleman said that he would rather clean up an exploded whale
than
to try to handle a powerful magnet that's covered in ferrofluid. And that's a hard call, but I think I can understand where he's coming from, because I don't see how you would clean that up. Like, that's crazy to me.
This one definitely seems pretty strange.
It's hard enough to clean up, like, something that has, you know, a plate that has some spaghetti sauce on there that's oily, you know? Like, it can be tough to come off of there. You add in that it's actually magnetized at the same time to the plate, and you got a problem, my friend. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's fascinating science, but it definitely seems like a problem. And one that I do not intend to deal with.
Yep, we're just going to report on this one. I don't think we're going to actually try to have a giant magnet like that
in the
studio.
This just falls under the Stunt Granny Loves Fun with Science experiments.
Yes, we're happy to report on it. I think it would wipe out our hard drive if we tried to do anything like that. So,
I guess that was the other interesting thing, like, because he was filming videos for all this stuff, and they're filming videos for this. Like, I wonder what precautions you need to take to film this stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I think you never watched Breaking Bad, I don't think.
No, I did not watch the Breaking Bad.
Well, I think there was a scene in that where he used a giant like electromagnet to wipe out some hard drives that were in evidence at one point.
Oh, okay.
Which would have been much more powerful, actually, than what was the magnet we saw in this video. Yeah, the magnet in the video, I feel like, would still be bad enough to be able to do some
damage.
Although, if it was on the other side of the room, you might be safe still, you know, with your, if you had, because I feel like they were positioning their cameras, you know, not super close necessarily, but
yeah,
I could be wrong.
It was definitely away from where they were doing the experiment.
Yeah, but that was I thought that was a cool video just from a suspense level too, because like you were not really sure how it was going to end up working out with these two big magnets, which I guess are, like you said, fairly fragile, sort of like a porcelain. If they they would be brittle, basically.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons why he had built the contraption that he did to stick them together. You can't just thump them together.
Yeah.
Or else, like you said, they break.
And you just have some magnetic rubble, which it's not as good, because then you don't have that.
that is some expensive rubble.
You want that solid magnetic field there, so you can do these cool experiments with it.
Oh,
not just
man.
A pile of little magnets. So, speaking of rubble, Kevin.
I thought you were going to go with speaking of experiments, but rubble works.
Yes. There was some interesting...
Barney rubble?
Nope, we're not talking about the Flintstones in this one, although they were, you know, of course, a Stone Age family, which would make sense. These would be quite before, a time quite before cavemen, I'm afraid, is what we're talking about here. And some old rocks that were found on all places on the moon. Now, these rocks were not moon rocks, though, they said. They actually came from Earth.
It was one of the original rocks that the first moon landing picked up.
This is wild to me. Like, they just happened to pick up this rock.
Because, they did pick up legitimate moon rocks, but among the rocks that they picked up was one that had come from Earth and found itself on the moon.
Yeah.
And just the fact that they mentioned that an asteroid or some type of object needed to hit the surface of the moon at the proper time to pop it up onto the surface of the moon.
Oh, yeah. So
for
it's like
it
a...
to be found.
Right. So it's a two-parter.
Yeah. There's a lot to unpackage here.
For this rock to get to the moon in the first place, it had to have gotten there after being ejected into outer space, basically, from the force of a asteroid impact, is what it looks like.
Yeah, and they said between 4 and 4.1 billion years ago.
So this rock would have started out somewhere underneath the surface of the Earth. The impact from this asteroid or meteor or whatever ejected it, along with some other debris, we would assume, into space, where it went all the way to the moon.
And they did mention in this article that at this time, the moon was closer to the Earth than it is at the present time.
Yeah.
Which made this possible.
Yeah. It's still... And I also believe that at this time, the Earth was being bombarded by a lot more asteroids and things of that nature. So this would, you know, have been not quite the, like, one in a million chance that they would have found one of these rocks, since this would have been happening a lot during that time. But it was interesting because over time this would have been kind of buried underneath other things on the moon, and a separate impact knocked the rock to the surface of the moon and allowed the astronauts to collect it when they were there.
Yeah,
so it is kind of a twofer.
Yeah, they were saying that it would have approximately been 12.4 miles below the surface of the Earth.
When it first formed.
It first formed.
Yeah.
Which is pretty bonkers. Like, that's pretty deep down there.
Yeah, so that's like, what, 4 billion years ago, too. So that is very on in the early on in the Earth's history. I believe the whole universe is 13 billion years, they think. The Earth is not much older than 4 billion years, I don't think. So that would have been early days.
Yeah, so we should not feel bad about our age. No. The Earth is 4 billion years old.
Hey, Kevin, want to feel old? The Earth was formed 4 billion years ago. I think that's what we're saying.
Oh, man.
Oh, I can remember when it was only 3.99 billion years ago. Damn.
Yeah, because, the Cone Crater was where this was found, and it was formed 26 million years ago. So, I mean, that's quite a difference in time. From 2 billion to 26 million. That's a...
Oh, 4 billion, right? So that would have been...
Oh, 4... Yeah, I'm sorry.
So that
sorry,
is quite 4. A bit faster or more recent.
Yeah.
Although, you know, you could argue 26 million years is quite a long time still.
yeah.
I think that would have been dinosaur... After the dinosaurs, maybe, still... Because I think the dinosaurs were like 60 million years ago.
Oh, okay.
So this would have been post-dinosaurs, I want to say. So yeah, still relatively recent, but only in...
Yeah, only in the scope of the universe, not in the scope of any human being's life.
Exactly.
Even those in the Bible that may have lived several hundred years would an elf length life...
or at least a half elf.
Half elf life. Still would pale in comparison to these time frames.
Yep. I don't even think Elrond was that old. So. That's pretty crazy.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I thought this was a wild story. And I hadn't really realized that there was. Like, I thought at first that they were saying. That this was because from the moon forming from like a collision with the Earth, but it actually was something that happened later.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't realized happened.
Yeah.
It seems weird to think about something hitting the Earth so hard that it actually knocks debris up into space all the way to the moon. But I guess it's happened. Hopefully not, anytime in the near future, though.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind getting through my life without having to worry about Ben Affleck and Bruce Willis going up into space to destroy an asteroid that is hurtling towards Earth.
Sure, and let's not forget Steve Buscemi, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to think. Michael Madsen, was he in that one?
I can't remember if he was in that one or not.
I might just be mixing him up with one of the other movies of the time.
I know that, well, Liv Tyler didn't go up there, but...
She was in that movie, for sure.
But yep. She was in that movie.
So they were famously drillers in that movie, Kevin. And this puts me in mind of another tunneling operation.
This might be the segue show to beat all segue shows. I don't know if we can top this, Ken.
This is going to be our highlight reel for the Seggies.
we can only hope that Superfan Josh nominates this one for Segways of the Year. It's some arcane podcast award show.
There really should be a Segway of the Year category, I feel like. somewhere. Or even just an award show based around it. Why not?
Yeah, and it is kind of interesting that the tunneling also merges with one of our favorite topics, which is heist stories. We have moved away from them as of recently.
They're pulling us back in, Kevin. Just when we thought we got out.
They pulled us back in. but this one is a heist not gone so well.
Yeah.
Or not gone at all, honestly. It was in the planning stages.
Well, I have a theory, but let's first set up exactly what happened here.
Of course, this took place in Florida. The level of surprise that this took place in Florida is not very high. Everyone thought that there was a sinkhole near a highway.
Yes.
But it turns out that it was a man-made tunnel that was about 50 yards long with a power cord and a small generator inside. And it was approximately 2, possibly 3 foot in diameter.
Yeah.
Which, that is really tight. Like, I guess I did not measure from shoulder to shoulder to see how wide I am. But considering that I wear a size 34 jean, I'm going to guess if that's a true 34 inches, this would be extremely claustrophobic.
Yeah, I mean, this is like insane to me. Like, to think that somebody would think that this is a good idea. I'm guessing that this had to be, although I would think it had to be a younger person, not somebody who is particularly well versed in engineering things of that nature, because the tunnel did collapse apparently, and that's what they were kind of alerted to it.
Yeah, that was why the quote unquote sinkhole opened up, was because of the tunnel collapse.
Yeah, and to think that they had made it for 50 yards, like, can you imagine tunneling underground? I'm guessing, well, I don't know. They had some generator, so maybe there was a power tool involved. But you're in a little 2 or 3 foot
diameter hole.
You know, maybe you have a little flashlight or something. Going 50 yards underground, I would be freaking out thinking, you know, all right, in my fear, or I don't know, what my theory. I mean, they found this place with the generator outside of it, right?
Yes.
The tunnel collapsed. Like, I'm thinking the guy might have been in there digging at the time when it collapsed.
And yeah, because at least at the time of the publishing this article, and it does not look like we have any further updates on it, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. It's, what did they say this took place in? We don't have a...
Florida, of course, again.
Yeah, yeah.
but it was going towards Pembroke Pines, Florida.
Ah, thank you, sir. Yeah, I'm just trying to see if there was any updates.
It doesn't look like it. Well, yeah, when a hole is that small, like, to me, it's one of those things that I'm kind of interested in how they removed the dirt from the area. You know, because if you're boring out a larger hole, you can kind of understand, you know, moving a bucket back or something like that. When you have that little of a hole, like, you really don't have a lot of room to turn around. I mean, I suppose you could be using some type of small personal device to dig it out. But even at that point, don't you realize that it's going to be tough to fit your person down in there? Because it's not creating a large enough hole?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this would take a huge amount of time. Because, like you said, you'd have to bring the dirt out with you. Somehow, like, crawling backwards. And as you're digging further, that's going to take longer and longer to make each round trip.
Yeah, this seems very inefficient, to say the least.
Yeah, this article says, what confused investigators was how anyone imagined successfully penetrating a high-security bank from underground through a tunnel that appears to be dug with pickaxes. Oh, pickaxes, huh?
Oh my gosh.
Everybody here...
Like, how did you swing that in a hole that small?
Everybody here is just shaking their heads, he said. They could have been going for the ATM. They could have been going for the vault. But after the would-be bank thief reached the ultimate destination, Agent Levrock speculated, then what?
Yeah, because you're just not going to use a pickaxe to get through the concrete.
Oh, so there was a wagon to haul dirt, as well as a generator and a winch, which can be used to haul heavy loads. So maybe they were using that to somehow pull the dirt out, I guess. So yeah,
it still seems inefficient as hell.
Although, all right, so the agent here has said this is more of a caper. If there was something dead, we would be smelling it. So I guess they're poo-pooing my theory. That it was not a fatal occurrence. So that's good, I guess. I don't like to think about somebody dying that way. It's kind of like a bad way to go, I feel like.
Yeah, there's a reason that the trope of being buried alive is a frequent one in the movies.
Yeah.
You know, they could have used the five-finger death punch to get themselves out of there.
Was that that's what she used to kill Bill at the end, I think. Oh, sorry, spoilers.
But wasn't she, oh, no, it was the 5-6-inch punch or something?
Yes, I believe so.
That she was using to get out of that. Yeah, sorry, wrong style of punch. To get out of the buried alive situation.
Yeah, that was pretty messed up.
But I just remember that. I feel like I've seen that on a number of television programs. I do believe that Nick, and I'm trying to think of what his real name is, from CSI got buried alive at one juncture.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was Greg.
It's an enduring,
it's been a while,
trope, I would say.
Yeah.
It is a terrifying situation. And a lot of people have claustrophobia, so probably...
yeah, there's a meeting of phobias, yeah. that really helps people squirm for that one. But yeah, this caper did not really go as far as any other can. This one is definitely a fail.
Mm. Yep.
A big fat F for whomever or whomevers did this.
It had a lot of imagination, but really not a lot much else going for it.
Well, Ken, last topic of the evening also involves quite a bit of imagination.
Yeah, somebody had to come up with this idea.
Yeah, and urban farming is definitely something that... that is more on everyone's minds these days. I know that I have certainly done my own level of trying to grow fruits. Well, not fruits, mostly vegetables, and even at the condo. And we will be undertaking such a task this coming year at the house. I did not think about doing so with mushrooms.
No, I hadn't either, actually. And I think that could actually make some sense. Especially since I realized I do, you know, like the taste of mushrooms.
Yeah, so. And they are quite good for you. They, they provide a number of health benefits. They're high in protein. So, yeah, there
are people who are trying to, you know, cut back on meat,
Yeah, if you want to go vegetarian, it is definitely a source of protein for those persons.
Yeah. Spending less money on transportation, you end up with like less food waste if you have your food growing right there on site, which is what we're basically talking about. So like this company, I forget what they're called now. It starts with an H. I want to say,
Smallhold.
Smallhold. That's it. I was thinking of the hold there. Smallhold has these automated mushroom growing cabinets, I guess.
Yeah,
you could call it systems, maybe mini farms. I think they're called. That they've put up in a few different locations for a lot of restaurants. It looks like.
More recently in a Whole Foods.
Yes.
You can grow many types of mushrooms, which is pretty ingenious, because I do remember one of my old coworkers foraging for some expensive chanterelle mushrooms.
Right.
And if you could honestly grow something that is that expensive in a grow cabinet, that would certainly help people enjoy such a tasty mushroom more frequently. And I would think that it would cut down on the cost of said mushrooms.
Well, I thought it was interesting that it is a good-looking display, I would say, for the mushrooms. It kind of...
they compared it to a disco.
A rave, I believe, as well.
And a rave.
Which maybe is taking it a bit too far. It is a mushroom growing box, basically.
There was no thumping music. There was no DJ.
No, and these were not that kind of mushrooms either. That you might associate with that kind of experience, but more of the like you said, gourmet kind of mushrooms that you might otherwise have to trek through the woods at the right time of year when the conditions are right, or potentially grow them right in your restaurant or grocery store at all times. And they are able to kind of to really create controlled environments with different types of environments depending on the kind of mushroom that you're trying to grow. And potentially you could have more than one, environment variety going on at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah, which I think that's what made me think. I know that our good buddy Tim also is a mushroom forager.
Oh, right.
And it's been quite awesome when he's brought me fresh mushrooms. Because I do remember impressing the now wife with a four-mushroom risotto. when we first started dating, from all fresh mushrooms, freshly picked in the hills in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So yeah, it would be kind of fun to be able to get all kinds of different mushrooms out of this. It's something that they do not list a price for this box.
And I feel like that could be something of a criticism of the concept here, if it's not something that could actually be scalable or sustainable, if it's more of a boutique kind of thing versus something that could actually be used large scale for people everywhere. Could this be something that everybody could have in their kitchen, I guess? The verdict is definitely out at this point.
Well,
I'm saying not, probably.
Yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things where it doesn't need to be for everyone. Like, I guess I'm thinking about, and thinking of fruits, the square watermelons that are grown in Japan to fit in their small refrigerators, because they basically just grow to the shape of whatever they're in. Obviously, naturally, they grow into an ovaloid shape if left on their own. But if you put them in any type of container, they will just grow to that shape.
You think you could do the same with mushrooms?
Oh, no, I'm not saying I could do that for mushrooms. I'm just saying that sometimes the people complaining were complaining that this couldn't be used everywhere. But I guess my point is that this is definitely for more of an urban environment, because I believe that, you know, I have enough of a backyard that I could probably find some way to properly build an area to grow mushrooms.
Yeah.
You know, it would so be it's nice not something that maybe I necessarily would need per se if I looked into mushroom growing properly.
Although this does promise to sort of take care of the moisturizing of the mushrooms and the, whatever lighting needs they need, monitor the mushrooms, communicate with a central cloud server to sort of
create the correct conditions
to learn what the conditions, you know, are working best, you know, to grow the mushrooms in.
Yeah. And I mean, I thought that that was fascinating too. Like, to me, that's just research. Like, if you're finding out what mushroom types grow in what, you know, what conditions, other people could reproduce those if you share that information. So, like, even if you don't have this box necessarily, you could, from their cloud server information, figure out how to properly grow these mushrooms.
Yeah, if they're sharing that, I guess.
Yeah, if they're sharing that. Even if it came at a cost, I would think that it'd be worth it. Like, it, I mean, I can't buy plants for free, so buying this type of data, whether it was in book form or just digital form, seems pretty reasonable to me.
Yeah, or they could just use that proprietary knowledge to sort of corner the market of for mushrooms. I don't know if they could be the next Microsoft of the mushroom world.
Well, that would be pretty interesting if they decided to go that route, Ken.
So stay tuned. We'll cover that if that ends up being the case, for sure. They are the mushroom overlords of the future.
Well, Ken, I think that about wraps things up for the stories. I did have to grab the Belltime beer on the way down here to your location.
Yeah.
And it was one that, for whatever reason, I've been drinking a lot of Columbus Brewing Company beers recently. I don't know if it's just easy to find them in six packs, which has been one of the things that I've done more recently, is just buying a six pack and enjoying beverages. But this one is milk, a cream stout.
Mm.
And I've got to admit, it's quite tasty. It is a definitely not a high octane beer. At 5.6%, it is quite drinkable.
Yes.
And yeah, like it's not quite as sweet as a normal milk stout.
Yeah.
But there is lactose in this, as it was warned on the packaging. But I think the cream part kind of changes up the feel of it a little bit, the mouth feel of it.
Yeah, when you said that, it does taste it like a definitely a stout. I didn't pick up as much as the milk either, but I have enjoyed it, and I've been enjoying, I think, the darker beers here in the winter months, so this
yeah.
is continuing with that theme.
It is certainly one of the darker beers are meant to be for the winter months. So yeah, If you happen to be in the area where they distribute, it is definitely a solid recommendation on my part if you do like the darker beers. So I believe with that, we can get on out of here. I'm at DeFrango11. That's at Gozer33, the brand Stunt Granny. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Hey.
Finally got that. I caught myself yesterday recording with Jeremy. And I might actually fully remember next week. Well, the week after next when I get back to recording. Hopefully you enjoy the show. So, yeah, rate us, review us.
Have a great week.